Our next guest, we're just very excited to have. She's a patriot, which is about the highest compliment I can give to somebody. She has a passion for knowledge, a passion for the truth. She's a researcher. Her website, anticorruptionsociety.com, anticorruptionsociety.com. Since 2010, she's been doing that and revealing the truth to anybody who wants to hear it. And I'm sure you're going to love her, Al Whitney. Al, welcome to the Power Hour.
Hi, it's wonderful to be here.
Yes, it's so good to have you. We were talking during the break about that discussion, and you were telling me something about the Federal Reserve in the early 20s, kind of add to this discussion, kind of the nail in the coffin, so to speak, for our Treasury. Why don't you go ahead and tell that story?
Yeah, I read this, and I don't know if you're familiar with a book called Judge Dale's The Great American Adventure, but he said that the Federal Reserve took over the Treasury in 1920, and I thought, well, that's strange. And I went to find it, and lo and behold, if you do a search for the Independent Treasury Act of 1920, you will see that Congress turned over the whole Department of Treasury to the Federal Reserve, including the offices, the chairs, the desks. I mean, they turned the whole thing over so that officially, if we're thinking that there is a U.S. Department of Treasury that belongs to the U.S. government, that just simply is not the case. It is now owned and controlled. And according to Jim Traficant from Ohio, in 1933, they turned the Treasury over to the International Monetary Fund. So it's really not our Treasury.
We're going to get back to that. I think that's an important capstone, probably, to this discussion about from 1917 to 1933. I also heard that in the original Federal Reserve Charter, and it's been so, you know, on Google, you can't even search the way you used to could. I can't even find the stuff anymore, the stuff I used to know. I've forgotten more than I know, you know, that's so to speak. But I had heard that the original Federal Reserve Charter said that America was going to pay the Federal Reserve the debt back in gold, that they were going to take the gold that way. That's maybe the entrance, how they began to pull our wealth out of us. Have you heard anything about that?
No, but I do know that from that book, An Astounding Exposure, written by Lewis McFadden, they did indeed, from I don't know when they started, they got their original charter in 1913, but all through the 20s, they were pillaging the gold, and they were shipping it overseas. They were stealing the gold out of the Treasury since it was in their possession, and they were shipping it out and sending it overseas. The only gold left to take was the gold of the people, right, which they did in 33.
I'm going to give a little summary up until 1913-17, and you tell me. You know, you may disagree or you may have a different information. You kind of fill in the holes or what have you. To me, the two great constitutional battles of the 19th century were Andrew Jackson fighting off the central banks in the 1830s, and then the Civil War time, the central bank getting their hooks back in us. And then after that, the corporate United States being set up, the capital, so to speak, the 10-mile square of Washington that was commissioned in the Constitution, kind of got out of hand and started to take over the whole thing. And that was in right after the Civil War. And that just continued to grow and to grow and to grow all the way up until 1913. Would that be a fair background or fair summary to you?
Yes. In fact, I heard one speaker talk about what happened with the Civil War, and he had a different take on it, which made all the sense in the world. He is saying that when they passed the Reconstruction Act, which was in the 14th Amendment, at that time after the Civil War, they pretty much shut down the states in the state sovereignty, and they put all of the people, instead of being Ohioans and Pennsylvanians, all the people were made these 14th Amendment citizens of the federal corporation. And he claims that that's when we really lost the Constitution, because prior to then, the states could nullify any federal law that they didn't want to abide by. But after that, he claims that states don't do that. They never do that. I don't know a state who nullifies a federal law. And so they pretty much took away the sovereignty of all of the states. Which,
now, this
again,
is some
go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You finish, Al.
Well, that's what he claimed is when they killed the Constitution. They wanted that the Constitution dead, and the Constitution did allow for the states some autonomy. And according to much of what I've read, they didn't want the states to have any autonomy. They wanted the states under their control, and they succeeded with the Reconstruction Act and the 14th Amendment.
This is, for people, this may seem, oh, what is it? This doesn't matter. This matters. When they began to make people, you know, are you a U.S. citizen? I'm a U.S. citizen, or I'm a Georgian. I was born in Georgia. I grew up in Georgia, or I'm a what have you. You know, I'm a New Jerseyan, or what have you. That's what, you know, Virginia, Ben Franklin. I'm a Virginian. When, now I lost my point that I was going to say. This is like Walmart. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to wear a pro-Hillary t-shirt or you want to wear a pro-Trump t-shirt, anybody can do that in America, right? You can go down the street and you can wear the shirt. If you work at Walmart, if you are a Walmart employee, you cannot wear the t-shirt. They won't let you. Even though that the Bill of Rights says that you can, your freedom of speech. Why? Why? Because you've agreed to a corporate structure and corporate employee bylaws. So that's the situation. That's the situation that we have with this. What she's talking about. What Al's talking about. We became Americans, free Americans, with dominion to now servile people under this corporate umbrella that started out real small. The difference seemed infinitesimal. Didn't seem any difference. Well, you know, fast forward 50 years in the Federal Reserve Act, and it became real different. Did that make sense to you, Al? What do you think?
Yeah, it does make sense. And you go back and you're talking about what happened at the Civil War. In 1868, when they passed the 14th Amendment, I just want to read you this one section, if you don't mind. The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services, in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, that would be the Civil War, right, shall not be questioned. But neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss or emancipation of any slave, but all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal.
Many conversations I've had, maybe some of you have had similar, and they start to explain the you know, this idea about this separate system, this isn't America anymore, and they're like, what do you mean this isn't America anymore? I see the flag, I see the president, I see the White House, what are you talking about? I live in the same house, what do you mean? But this is what we're talking about, the pulling us away, the destruction of our inheritance, of the Constitution, the suppression of it, to the advantage of private central bankers, hell-bent on taking everything that is not tied down, including your sovereignty, especially your sovereignty. We're talking to Al Whitney from the Anti-Corruption Society, anticorruptionsociety.com, and her just wealth of knowledge on this subject is extremely important. Before the break, Al, we were talking about the act right there at 1868, right after the Civil War, that all this debt was going to be not even questioned. Go ahead and finish that thought, if you would.
Yeah. I mean, it was in the 14th Amendment. I'll read it again because maybe, you know, people might have missed it. But Section 4 of the 14th Amendment, and this is the amendment that turned all Ohioans and all Pennsylvanians into U.S. citizens. That was Section 1. But Section 4 says the validity of the public debt of the United States, that's one entity, authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. So they're saying that the cost of the North to attack the South, and the South is considered now an insurrection because they lost, right? Right. So they are not allowed to question that they owe money, that there are bounties for. There was a debt created, and nobody's allowed to question it.
Dear God. And boy, and they took from the South too, ladies and gentlemen. They took from the South, let me tell you. That's why, you know, 100 years later, the sentiment, when I was a small child, the sentiment in the South, the Deep South, especially when I visited some of my relatives, they hated the North. Still, 100 freaking years later, they hated the North. Really. That's what went on. Anyway, let's get back to the story, Al, as kind of a side note. After the Civil War, after this act leading up to the Federal Reserve Act and then into 1917.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are aware that the money monsters, I call them the money monsters, some people call them the robber barons, others call them the international banking cartel, but they sort of staged a fake depression in the early 1900s, so there was a run on the bank. That's what they wanted. They want runs on the banks, so then they could step in and say, well, we can't let the government control the monetary system and the banks in this country. It's too political, so we're going to write a bill where a private outside interest will do it for the benefit of everybody. And I think people, a lot of your listeners, should certainly be aware that the when the Federal Reserve was passed in 1913, it turned over the monetary policy for the country to a private cabal of international bankers. And they've had it ever since.
I think it was J.P. Morgan, all his people, they kind of spearheaded that. The talk was almost like a briar rabbit, kind of, you know, don't throw me in the briar patch, the rabbit. Kind of thing. The banks, oh, don't pass this Federal Reserve Act. Whatever you do, don't pass that. Yeah. So the Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913. What were some of the distinguishing and important features of that, maybe, that we should know for this conversation?
Well, one of the things that I ran into, which really surprised me, because I found it on their website. I did put up a YouTube, oh, gosh, maybe 5 years ago, and I quoted it. They are saying that they were made the fiscal agent of the United States. Now, if you think about that, that's big. That's huge. The fiscal agent?
Yes.
That is on their website. And as they say, as the fiscal agent of the United States, it was the duty of the newly formed Federal Reserve to create war bonds for World War I. But if you look closely at history, it wasn't long after the Federal Reserve Act was passed that they maneuvered Wilson into entering into World War I. They already had that planned to get our country into World War I, and of course that would create a debt for the country, wouldn't it? To them.
How convenient. That's good. Good work if you can get it, I guess.
And
1917.
One of the things I heard about Ed Bernays, if anybody's familiar with him, he is supposedly the father of propaganda. It was his job to create the propaganda to get the American people all revved up to go into war against Germany. And he did such a successful job that he was actually invited to attend the Treaty of Versailles after the war, and he received honors for his participation in getting the American people to support World War I when the American people had nothing against Germany, and there were all kinds of Germans in our country, and nobody wanted to go overseas in war. But again, that was the plan. The bankers wanted
more. Now, you made an excellent point. I think it's maybe the most important aspect in this, as we talk about, you know, justice, constitution, law, what have you. You made a certain point about money and about the legal system. Could you repeat that?
Yeah, money always follows the legal system. People have to understand that. So if you've got plenty of money, which is not backed by gold or silver, then you have to have a legal system that supports that money. And the reason is that contracts have consideration. They're not only talking about your paying debts, which we are. We're also talking about all contracts. All contracts have, one of the components a contract must have is a consideration. Now, that can be defined differently, but the legal system has to support the money system. So if you look anywhere for, if you violate any law whatsoever, you're going to be fined in dollars. You will not be able to pay a fine, a fee, or a penalty in silver or gold. So the two go hand in hand.
I think that's such a key point. The legal system follows the money system. And in the early or mid-teens, 1913 on, the 20s, early 20s, you still had these two competing systems. I mean, if you get nothing out of this, ladies and gentlemen, I personally think that's the most important. There in the 20s, take what Al just said. The legal system follows the money system. What legal system? What law were they exercising? What law were they under? What law were they doing? Well, in the 20s, you had a $20 gold piece that was money, and then you had a $20 Federal Reserve note that was money also operating at the exact same time. Do you see where it's split from 1913? And the energy now was going, which way would America go? Would we go towards this corporate fake system? Or would we go towards back towards our constitutional roots? Which way would we go? I hope that everybody sees that break there. This is the key perilous moment of our republic in the 20th century.